Today, returning to the conversation about the self-ish.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Now, presume if you have listened to any episodes before, presumably you noticed that we have some new music starting today, which is really nice. I mean, we've gone through more than 200 episodes, and my son just contacted me and said he produced the first music that we had also, which we loved and have loved all along. But he contacted me and just said he was interested in creating some new music for us, and so he worked with his friend, Duran Danoff, a guy that produces commercial music and obviously does it really well, and they produced a new theme song for us. So I love it. I mean, we both love it. Daisy, who produces for me, just loves the music. So do I. So, you know, every time you hear it, you're going to hear our voices going over it. So you never get to really hear the music. So let's pause for a moment and give you one opportunity to hear through the music from beginning to end without disruption. Okay, just seriously, isn't that the greatest? I love it. I know you probably did. I don't know whether it matters to you or not, but it matters to us and it matters to me. And wow, Philip, thank you so much for producing some great music for us, and Duran for taking time to help us with that. It makes a huge difference. So that'll be our background music for a good while to come. Now, back to the topic we were talking about, where I had introduced the idea that we do think about ourselves in a certain way. So I'm not going to rehash the whole discussion because I need to move forward with it. But the point is that it's very difficult to identify what it means to be us without recognizing that we're part of a community. That's just part of our identity. It's part of how we understand who we are. Even in a very strongly individualistic society, we have that sense. So I spent a good deal of time talking about that in the last episode. And then the moral conundrum that comes with that, that while we would like to be able to give space to everyone else to do what they want to do, to the extent that it doesn't violate everyone else's ability to do what they want to do. So in other words, just maximize liberty. It's a very common libertarian idea. No big news there. But the moral conundrum that comes is that we do recognize that there are some things culturally that we have to find a way to be able to say are wrong for other cultures, not just for ours. And I won't rehash that whole part of the end of the discussion from last time. But, you know, when you're talking about the difference in the ways, this is the end of that discussion from last time, briefly put. When you're talking about the ways people greet each other differently in different cultures, obviously you make space for that and just say, oh, your culture does it differently than ours and one's not better than the other. We're just different. But when it comes to genocide, you don't say that. Oh, your culture practices genocide against anyone with a different religion or a different skin color or a different facial characteristics or a different whatever. No, we don't do that. And even though it was really challenging for us as an international community to figure out how to address that in the mid-20th century, we did. And we decided that's not okay. It is okay for us to cross cultural boundaries and acknowledge that there are some things that are just so absolutely wrong that we can't pretend they're okay. What that means for enforcement, what it means for the power we're willing to use in order to enforce it in some way, is a completely different question. But the ability to recognize that something could be universally wrong, that's a substantial step for humanity. It's a substantial step for us to take. Not the shallow, simplistic, you don't do things the way I do, so you must be wrong. Not that. This is recognizing the value of cultural plurality and of individualism, but also recognizing that there are some limitations to it, which is why we started using the term human rights in the mid-20th century. And you can imagine why it all comes to a head in the mid-20th century, not because any of the atrocities were brand new, but because they were new in our self-awareness, especially in transatlantic culture, European culture, and American culture. For us to say, you mean we do these things too? It was shocking to us to recognize the kinds of atrocities that we could take up with cultural aplomb, by the way, not just accidentally tolerate, but actually embrace and pat ourselves on the back for until we realized that what we were doing was evil. So all of that said, to make the point, there is a challenge for us on how to balance that respect for others that allows them to do things the way they want to do them, and our respect for rightness that demands that we point out when things are wrong, regardless of how much force we're going to put into defending that thing. And so that's the point I wanted to get to now on the way of this whole journey that we're taking, talking about the sort of intersection between our recognition of ourselves as individuals that have value, but also members of a community that has value, but also part of a world that has different cultures that have value because they're different, and yet still need some recognition of the accountability that crosses those cultural boundaries. So here's the middle point that we need to address, which is how uncomfortable we are with the idea of communal guilt. And believe me, I can talk about this. I'm an expert on this, not because I have scholarly insight into it, but because I've spoken about it in the past and was barraged with pushback. Could not believe the level of pushback I got for very simple ideas like Daniel's prayer, just acknowledging that we can actually carry some guilt and some shame because of the community we're a part of. Now, I say all that, and I know we're not super comfortable with it, so that's what I want to point out. I recognize that, and I can understand why, because I love the idea of individual responsibility, and don't just love it, I defend the idea of personal responsibility, that if I don't, and we talked about this in the last episode, so I won't rehash it here, go back and listen to it if you want to hear it thoroughly defended. I defend the idea that personal moral responsibility comes with personal moral agency. I am making choices, therefore I am guilty. And that's fundamental to me. I defend it adamantly from every possible angle that it can be defended. And yet, there's this thing we need to figure out about how a culture could do things that are wrong. And then there's an implication that comes with that when we recognize how strongly our psyche, ourselves, are shaped by our culture. So the first step in this, what we need to talk about today, is our discomfort with communal guilt. And yet there has to be some way, and this is where I did stop last time, there has to be some way to make sense of what is culturally obviously contemptible behavior, like genocide I was talking about, but I'll give a different example here in a second, which remains, and this is the trick, this is what makes it a conundrum for us, which remains permanently below the threshold of an individual's conscience. They don't get it. They really don't know that what they're doing is wrong. Now, I know you can say, and I would defend it most of the time, well, you know, they're just choosing not to know it. There's some validity to that statement. I'm not going to brush it off as if it doesn't have some strength to it. And yet, there is just a practical reality that if you, so let me give you an example, like of, let's say a culture where there is a level of personal moral incompetence, meaning as an individual, you really just don't know that some people would think that's wrong. And I am ashamed to confess it. I'm ashamed to admit it. But I do know when I was growing up, the cultural environment that I was in, and this goes from grandparents down to me, that the jokes I heard, the whole setting of the culture that I was in, there was a lot of racism. And I don't mean subtle or implicit bias. I don't mean that. I mean racism, like racist jokes, all of that kind of stuff. I'm like a six-year-old kid. All I know is, oh, look, that's the kind of stuff that's funny. I had to become an adult and realize in some of those jokes how much harm it was doing to someone else in a setting where I had not been in that relationship before. I had to see it in that context to go, wait a minute, something's wrong here. And in that moment, I didn't say, well, not my fault. I mean, it's not like I didn't know. In that moment, I realized I was wrong, and I didn't blame everybody else. I was blaming myself, but I was looking at it going, I never even realized that could be wrong. I didn't know there were any other options for how to think about it. Well, let me go way beyond a racist joke, even though that's bad enough. And again, I'm ashamed of that and have repented thoroughly and wish that I didn't have any vestige of that. And I pray that I don't, but I know better than that. We're not perfect, even in our repentance. So anyway, here's the thing that's even, you know, is way worse than that. If you're in a culture like Carthage, and, you know, Carthage, the sort of capital or head or, you know, central hub of the Phoenician Empire during the time when it was in competition with Rome. That's what I'm talking about, Carthage, in that era. The whole, and I've mentioned this to you before, I mean, the whole culture is built around this worship of gods who require child sacrifices, infant sacrifices. It's part of what we read about in Scripture with Molech and the practice of offering your little babies to Molech. And the amazing thing is that archaeologists, as they've done research in these places, and in Carthage in particular, they have found the caches where the bodies, where the sacrifices were offered. They have found the indications of these sacrifices being made, these child sacrifices, infant sacrifices. And what's worst about it is, so there are times when people would offer sort of a substitute for their child. And I can't remember what the substitutes were, if they were dummies of some kind or if they were pets or something else that they would offer instead of offering their child. And it was following the same kind of ritual. That was the idea. But in times of greatest need, it would be the child that was offered. And the amazing thing about this is that over time, and this is just based on the most recent history book I read about Carthage, and Daisy can give you a link to that book on the website if you get an opportunity to look at it. But the most amazing thing about it, and this was shocking to me, was that over time, I mean, wouldn't you think over time you would become more sophisticated, right? So like, oh yeah, sure, 3000 or 2000 BC, you know, or 1000 BC, they're offering child sacrifices. But, you know, by 300 BC or so, I mean, you know, they're not doing that anymore. They've grown out of it. They've realized that it was wrong. It's quite the opposite. The further you go into Carthaginian history in particular, the more actual child sacrifices there are. And maybe that's because the need was greater, the panic was greater, the crisis was greater, and the prayers were more sincere. But I mean, this is a repugnant, a morally repugnant practice, offering your children as sacrifices to preserve your own interests. It's just, it's almost inconceivable to us. And here's the challenge that goes with this. There is no possible universe in which it is right to slaughter little children so the adults can go on living their lives the way they want. There's no possible universe in which that could be right. I understand that there are places where it happens and that those people understood that what they were doing was their moral obligation, really their religious obligation, is as far as I'd be willing to go with that. I understand that that's the case. That doesn't change the fact that while there is no possible universe in which it's right to slaughter little children so the adults can go on living their lives the way they want, that there very much is a universe. This is the reality of the history of our world. There are cultures around the world throughout our history who do exactly that and who taught their children that it was the right thing to do from generation to generation for as long as the culture lasted. It is unimaginable that we would pretend that a child raised in that culture from one generation to the next would not in their minds have this prescription that says, I know this is painful, I know my empathy tells me not to do it, but I can't let my mercy guide me here. I've got to do the right thing and offer my child as a sacrifice and actually believe they're doing the right thing. And if you don't think that happens, you really should read Hannah Arendt. I got to get her in here. You know, I've got to squeeze her in when I can, on Adolf Eichmann and his testimony at trial, at the Nuremberg trials. I mean, not at the Nuremberg trials, in Jerusalem when he's on trial. Because, I mean, his whole testimony has to do with his very sincere belief that the only thing he ever did wrong in all of the time that he spent sending people to their slaughter in the Holocaust, that the only thing he ever did wrong was actually protecting one Jew that he actually favored. That's what he thought was wrong and should be repented of and confessed in the testimony that he gives at a trial for how he participated in the Holocaust. My point is, if you're raised in Carthage, you're not going to know that what you're doing is wrong. And yet, anyone from outside of Carthage should be able to look at it and say, it's horrible, immoral, ungodly, deserving of judgment that you are sacrificing your children in this way. And, you know, I think the only hesitation, the only reason people have hesitation about it, and they do, and even if you don't, let me just tell you, from not just millennials, but below that, the next generation down, the younger generations, they seriously have questions about this. There is, but and I believe it's partially because of this confusion. What we do is we take individualism's bias, this is not a bad bias, individualism's bias for avoiding judgment. There are lots of good reasons for having that bias, including judge not that you be not judged, which happens to be in the Bible. So this is not a bad bias. Individualism's bias for avoiding judgment ends up being applied to the way cultures relate to each other, as if cultures are individuals that are relating to each other. And so I take my desire as an individual, looking at another individual doing things I disagree with, and say, well, I don't know everything, and They do think about the world differently than I do, and maybe I disagree with them completely, and maybe I'm right and they're wrong, and yet they're not harming me, so I'm going to leave them alone. That's individualism's bias. Taking that and applying it to another culture. Well, I mean, and their culture, they do this weird stuff, you know, where they, some of the things we were talking about in the previous episode, yeah, they practice honor killings and some of their kids end up dead because they've shamed the family. But, you know, that's just their culture and it's not affecting my culture, so I should probably leave them alone. That metaphor, that analog between the way individuals relate to each other and the way cultures relate to each other, it's not one-to-one. And it shouldn't be taken as one-to-one. And there has to be some way for us to recognize why we can speak across cultural lines. Again, not even a question about enforcement. I'm not talking about military action. And we can have that discussion another day. That's a different political question. But simply having the ability to say their culture is not just different. In this case, their culture might be wrong. That's essential for us to understand if we're going to understand that anything at all has some moral basis to it, that there's some. So let me put it to you this way. Just take a break with me for a second. Ever since I was a child, and I mean in elementary school, I thought whale sharks were absolutely the coolest thing in the world. Now, I've broadened my perspective on the world since then, and now the moon and stars may take precedence over whale sharks, but not a lot. I mean, when I learned how to do scuba diving, when I got certification for scuba diving, in the back of my mind, there was only one reason to do that. I want to see a whale shark. Now, the reality is I'm never going to see a whale shark underwater. I get that because I'm not going to go through all the effort to go pursue pelagics somewhere out in the middle of the ocean or in the middle of the Gulf of California or whatever that's called down, you know, south of California, where whale sharks might be found or they might be seen in a scuba diving environment. I'm not ever going to get to do that. I get that. But I still admire whale sharks. And the closest I've come to it is not close to me being close to a whale shark. But the closest I have come to it was when I was scuba diving, and we saw some pretty remarkable things in the Gulf of Mexico. Just me and a half dozen of my friends were diving beneath this boat out in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. Not in the middle, you know, a few miles out. And so we were having a good time. We dove a little wreck that was down there and some stuff like that. And we came back up. And when we surfaced, we were talking about it. Oh, did you see that? I think there was even a 5 or 6 foot shark in that particular dive that we happened to see that swam by. Didn't pay any attention to us, didn't care about us. And it was intimidating, but whatever. And we were just, oh, you know, I couldn't believe it. And did you see this fish and that fish? And did you see, you know, whatever. And it was amazing. And then the guys who were on the boat, you know, who took us out into the Gulf and dropped us off, or they didn't drop us off, they stayed there. They were telling us, well, you know, just a week ago or 2 weeks ago, I can't remember how long it was, but not long before, they said, you know, we were in the boat and we had people on the bottom who were diving and a whale shark swam right under us. And we just, you know, my response was, that doesn't seem true. I mean, we're in the Gulf of Mexico. I don't know of any whale sharks in the Gulf of Mexico. I've never heard of whale sharks in the Gulf of Mexico. And so I didn't say all that. I was just thinking it. And somebody said it. I didn't know there were any whale sharks in the Gulf of Mexico. And you know what their answer was? Their answer was, well, there are no fences in the ocean, you know, and it was obviously true. You know, if a whale shark chose to swim around the Horn or wherever and end up on this side instead of that side of some continent, that's just where they're going to be. Okay, so fascinating. And I was amazed by that, but I would apply exactly the same thing to cultures here. So it's not possible for us to pretend that there are isolated cultures. I know that we used to be able to say that. We used to be able to say, well, that culture's had no interaction with any other society and blah, blah, blah. I doubt that was even as true in the absolute terms that are used about it, about some of those fairly isolated cultures. But today, not happening. I mean, I understand, again, there are some cultures that are more isolated than other cultures and who have some natural barriers that keep them from this and that. But The reality is you can't go anywhere in the world that you're not going to run into vestiges of each other's, not just vestiges, but active participants in each other's cultures in that setting. And the idea then that we would not share a moral investment in the things we're doing as cultures is just not realistic. It's not something that can be defended. And in that context, we've got to figure out where those common moral lines are. So we've got to deal with that reality despite our discomfort with the idea that we could actually have an absolute moral issue that crosses cultural boundaries. Now, think about where the problem comes here. Because if I'm saying to someone in Carthage, you can't kill babies to defend your political interests as a culture, their response would be, well, that's what you say, but it's not what I say, because they would be defending themselves morally. And if I were to turn around, regardless of their opinion, regardless of what anyone else would say about it, if I were to turn around and just speak to myself about it or the people in my culture about it and say, there is a moral culpability on behalf of the Carthaginians for what they're doing with their little babies being sacrificed to Molech. If I say that, I am saying those individuals who were raised in an environment where they had no choice but to participate in that moral violation are guilty because they are Carthaginians. That's what I would be saying. So you can understand why I'm saying it creates a problem for us if we have a total disregard, complete denial of any concept of communal guilt, but then recognize that there is an absolute morality that could cross cultural lines, even to reach into those lives that are completely shaped by a culture doing those things that are wrong. And again, if you haven't, I mean, you don't have to read a lot of books to know that what I'm talking about isn't just possible. It happens everywhere, all the time. It's not like a handful of people would show up for lynchings in the late 19th all the way through the mid-20th century. It's not like a handful of people would show up. Go look up the pictures sometimes of one of the final lynchings in America that was public in Waco. There are thousands and thousands of people thronging to celebrate as a moral victory the lynching of this poor young man in Waco. Just go look it up for yourself. I'm not even going to create the link to it this time. My point is, we've got to figure out how we balance those things together, how we understand those things together, if we're going to make sense of where we actually are as human beings in a society with a moral obligation to something beyond us and beyond our society. You know, that would be God, in my view. And even if I were Immanuel Kant, it would be to the categorical moral imperative. So here's my point, and let me just try to run through this to make the point before we run out of time in this episode. We have a huge problem with shared guilt, that we just don't understand it. So when we think of the things we are most guilty of, you know, the burdens we're willing to acknowledge, oh, these are our worst sins, I think we think of them incorrectly. Our worst sins are not the sins we're most likely to hide. Those are the ones we like to play with. Those are the ones we like to, if we're in judgmental mode, tell everyone else, you're wicked because you do this stuff. You keep a secret from everyone else. And I remember the celebrations in church services. God's going to put that on a TV screen and show everyone you love what you did that was wrong, you know, to help make people feel guilty. We love to play with that stuff on the judgmental side. And we love to harbor that stuff on the private side. You know, that's what makes me me. You, nobody knows this about me but me. And because of that, it becomes easy for us to see those things as our worst sins. But, you know, there is an equivocation here on what we're guiltiest of, for instance, just on the nature of the word guilt, because there's a psychological state of guilt that doesn't have anything to do with absolute morality. It's just what makes us feel worst about ourselves. But there's also a forensic condition of guilt where you actually have guilt because of your standing in some moral court. And obviously, I mean, I believe in God, so I don't have any problem talking about a moral court of some kind. But again, even if I didn't, I'm Kantian in my ethics. I don't know how you can't be and actually have an absolute ethic at all. But I could hold that ethic and simply say, we are accountable because morality can't mean anything other than what it does. And all of us are accountable to that. But I think in the reality of where we are on our sins, where we are aware of certain things being wrong and we carry around this guilty state that we have, we have sort of a choice to make about how we think about them. I would call it a fideous choice. You know, you just have to make a leap about how you're going to understand it. On the one side, I've got a choice I could make to be a skeptic, to be a David Hume, and to interpret that guilt in this way, that all of that psychological state of guilt and the forensic condition, the real condition of guilt, sort of, that they're actually the same because, you know, it's just the artifice of the human psyche, which was produced by a culture that makes us feel that guilt to begin with. And all of our morality is completely derived from the cultural lessons that we've learned. I have that possibility for believing things from David Hume. It's a skeptic's view, but it's not an unrealistic description. He's not a fool. His philosophy is defensible. It's not, I don't agree with it, but it is defensible. I could make the choice and leap off the building on that side. So I'm going to be like David Hume, and I'm just going to say, well, if you have psychological guilt, that is guilt because your culture gave you your morality. And if you don't feel guilty about it, it's because you don't have guilt because that's what your culture gave you. But the other option, a more dualistic reading, one that acknowledges that there may be a reality beyond the material world and therefore also beyond the cultural world, is that we're like, you know, those who are shackled in Plato's cave. Don't have time to explain the whole analogy, but you can go read Book 7 of the Republic or just look up the cave allegory, and you can read about these people who are shackled there. And they can't know anything but the shadows that are passing in front of them from the light that's behind them, and they can't see it because they can't turn their heads and all that stuff. If you've read Plato's cave, you know what I'm talking about. Very brief allegory. You can go look it up. But if I take that reading, then our psychological condition of guilt, the things that make me feel guilty and of which I'm aware, that's wrong, but I just do it. Oh, man, I need to confess that. Our psychological condition of guilt, on the one hand, or esteem, you know, what a good boy am I, on the other hand, may be completely askew from our actual moral condition. The world is one way or the other. Either our actual moral condition and our psychological condition are inherently the same, or it's possible that they are askew from one another. And the problem I have is that, I mean, I say this is a problem, this is just the reality of it. Part of what's built into my understanding of the world is that we're accountable to something beyond ourselves. And so I can see a person having a psychological condition that condones entirely a certain set of behaviors, exactly the way I think Romans 2 talks about cultures condoning the things that they're doing with each other. They have other things they condemn, but that doesn't mean they get it all right. It just means they recognize that there is a moral condition that they ought to be satisfying. Every culture exists with that. I just have to acknowledge that I believe that we are accountable to something beyond ourselves, and therefore our worst sins would not be the ones we feel guilty about. Our worst sins would be the ones we celebrate with each other. Oh, look at all the babies they sacrificed, talking about Carthage again. That doesn't make it better. We celebrate it, and indeed it makes that our worst sin because we just plunge headlong into it and make it worse and worse over the centuries, which is exactly what happened in Carthage. And I'll defend this. I'm not you know, I'm not the biggest fan of C.S. Lewis, although he has brilliant arguments and some really fantastic stuff. It's not like I buy everything that he says, but there are so many things that he's able to say about human nature in the light of theology that are, you know, just spot on. And one of those is this recognition. So I want to read to you this little section from C.S. Lewis talking about hell in The Problem of Pain. I read this first when I was in college, and it had such a poignant impact on my understanding for the first time why it would make sense to us psychologically to think of hell the way it's described in Scripture with such negative connotations. Obviously, that's a slight way of saying it. So here, let me just quote this to you. And what I want you to hear mostly is the psychological state of the person who faces this sort of eternal torment or judgment that's coming his way. So C.S. Lewis, talking about hell in that way, says, first, there is an objection in many minds to the idea of retributive punishment as such at all. This has been partly, I'm quoting him, but I'm adding little commentaries along the way. This has been partly dealt with in a previous chapter. It was here maintained that all punishment became unjust if the ideas of ill desert and retribution were removed from it, and a core of righteousness was discovered within the vindictive passion itself in the demand that the evil man must not be left perfectly satisfied with his own evil. That's the point. That it's possible for a person to be perfectly satisfied with their own evil. So listen to the rest of this description. That it must be made to appear to him what it rightly appears to others, evil. This is exactly how the how the Jerusalem trial of Eichmann reads. Picture to yourself, I keep confusing the two, by the way, Nuremberg and Jerusalem trial, because exactly the same thing happens in Nuremberg with a different set of defendants. But they're all doing the same thing. Well, yeah, you get to try us because you won the war, but it's not because what we did was wrong. We were just trying to defend our culture. That is despicable, and it doesn't make them more right. It makes them more wrong and more deeply embedded in that wrongfulness. So C.S. Lewis goes on to say, picture to yourself a man who's risen to wealth or power by a continued course of treachery and cruelty, by exploiting, not like we can't think of people who are like this. This happens. So by a continued course of treachery and cruelty, by exploiting for purely selfish ends the noble emotions of his victims, laughing the while at their simplicity, who, having thus attained success, finally parts with the last rag of honor among thieves by betraying his own accomplices and jeering at their last moments of bewildered disillusionment. Without remorse or even misgiving, but eating like a schoolboy and sleeping like a healthy infant, unshakably confident to the very end that he alone has found the answer to the riddle of life, that his way of life is utterly successful, satisfactory, unassailable. What Lewis is doing in his argument overall, and this is borrowing the metaphor from Lewis himself, is he's following the idea that comes with a Thomas Aquinas and others to justify, in this case, the eternal suffering of hell, even, as a way to plant what he refers to as pain's flag of truth in the man's otherwise entirely ignorant fortress. This man believed what he was doing was the best thing to do. It was right, and it was justifiable, and he won the prize. And that man ends up, in Lewis's description, in this eternal place of torment, so that even in his ignorance, there can be this flag planted that says, no, what you did was not right. It crosses a cultural line because it's embedded in this man without any conscientiousness about it whatsoever. It crosses a cultural line, not in C.S. Lewis's point. He's just trying to get into that individual's conscience and plant that flag of truth about rightness using the only thing that remains, which is the pain of this eternal torment. I'm using that as the analogy to say there is a way for us to understand a person's conscientiousness as being devoid of true or genuine or righteous morality. And in that case, what they do doesn't suddenly become right there is still a moral pronouncement that could be made about it. It's hard to understand personal sin without personal agency, but there's plenty of room for it in Scripture and in the reality of our experience. The Carthage example is, that's why I brought up the example of Carthage. But in every culture, some select behaviors, we choose to condone them rather than condemn them, despite what may be indefensible about them in the light of any morality or ethic, which could have a basis in reality, rather than simply acknowledge that it's purely cultural preference. Of course, I mean, that basis for the morality, that's the ultimate question for all of us regarding ethics, and the topic of entirely different episodes, which I have covered before, talking about why ethics has to be what it is. But in this case, the ways of life we don't even put under the glass for examination, because they're part of the lens through which we see the whole world, those things are inevitably in our blind spot. We're not even trying to look for them. Those are the things about which we ought to have the most concern. Therefore, there's something shared, because we don't look at them, we don't examine them, we don't even think they could be wrong. There's something shared about those sins. That is, the bigger problem with shared guilt is that we hide ourselves from experiencing it as guilt, the psychological version, right? Persons may realize, they may experience the pangs of what they're doing in the group. I think that happens all the time. I think God created us for that to happen. Hence the empathy that comes up and says, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. No, I got to do it. I got to be a good soldier, you know, got to make it happen. So at the same moment that persons may realize, have the pangs of that guilt while they're doing it in the group, they hide their guilt in that very same group. By the way, I think an example of how that happens is with feral mobs and the de-individuation that takes place in those contexts, you know, when the herd mentality turns violent, which we've seen in our culture as well. And I could tell you just countless stories of soldiers, I mean, just reading The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, you know, Nazi and other versions, who are committing the most heinous atrocities lightheartedly. Cigarettes hanging out of their mouths, joking with their friends while they're slaughtering people. It happens. Okay, and I'm getting the hand signals from across the table that say, there's no realistic way you are going to finish your notes before this episode is out of time. So I will pause here and just say, what we need to grasp is why a person like John the Baptist or Elijah has to do the ministry the way they do their ministry. And their ministry is cultural. It's social. You know, it's not just, I'm the priest who's coming to say something. They're a prophet for their people. Why they're doing it from across the river and so on, and how that should shape the way we think of ministry. So rather than trying to rush to the conclusion today, let me come back next time with some illustrations, some examples of how this can play out in the way we think about ourselves, the way we think about other people in our culture, the way we think about our moral responsibility with each other and before God, or just before reality. Of course, I do mean before God, but also before reality, so that we can figure out who we're supposed to be in a society where we really have a hard time, not just a society, but in a reality where we have a hard time answering that question anyway, without just cloaking over it with a name. Well, I'm Barry Creamer, as if that tells you who I actually am. So in that context where I am Barry Creamer, and I am a Christian, and I am an American, and I live in a world where people are doing all kinds of things where we don't understand each other, in that context, what this would mean for us, hopefully some humility and repentance and some willingness to doubt ourselves and all. And we'll come back to figure out how we get there, at least try to get there, in the next episode.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.